Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
If you had to use one word, like, how would you describe the state of the Middle East right now, militarily?
Chaotic?
Yeah. Josh Keating covers international affairs over at Vox. I called him up because I needed someone to talk me through the relentless headlines I've been reading about the ripple effect of the war on Gaza.
The other big story this morning, the U.S. launching a new attack against a militant group in the Middle East.
What we have are these, like, lots of little conflicts all over the place.
This morning, explosions in the city of Erbil, Iraq, after neighboring Iran launched ballistic missiles.
Related violent episodes in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, in Yemen, in the Red Sea.
The strike came just hours after the Pentagon said a Houthi drone attacked a U.S. cargo ship.
You just see sort of little aspects of it popping up all over the place.
All of this raising concern about a wider spillover of violence across the region stemming from the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza.
Even if none of them are really full-scale war the way we're seeing in Gaza, like, there's definitely instability and violence in all these places, and they're all related.
Yeah, with some of these attacks, it's hard for me to even see how they connect back to Israel. It just seems like some kind of domino effect.
Yeah, I mean, well, for instance, you know, Iran launched missiles at this separatist group in Pakistan a few days ago, which does not appear to be directly related to what's going on in Gaza. But, you know, it sort of seems like while attention is elsewhere, they're sort of taking advantage of it to pursue other goals.
Josh says, to understand this ramp up in violence, you need to understand the choreographed dance many countries are doing right now. The primary players are Iran and Israel and the U.S. And then there are Iran's allies in Syria and Lebanon and Yemen. Yemen's Houthis have been fighting especially hard. They're punching above their weight, as Josh puts it. But even the Houthis fighting, it seems somewhat contained.
It's this strange dynamic where there's this sort of ongoing low boil war in the Middle East, this sort of low intensity conflict that happens within prescribed boundaries.
Is there a risk that the low boil kind of comes to a head, starts doing more than simmering?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the thing people are really concerned about right now. But, you know, I think if you look at the statements coming out of Tehran, they express solidarity with the Palestinian people, they condemn Israel, but they don't say they're going to war.
So if a wider war is unlikely, why does it feel like that wider war is already happening? Today on the show, how Iran and its axis of resistance are keeping the pressure on in the Middle East. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I want to go back to the beginning of this escalation we're seeing now to see if we can just talk about how it all began. After October 7th, what happened outside of Israel at that moment? Like, how did the conflict begin to make itself apparent in places outside of Israel and Gaza?
Well, I think it started on the northern border. I think you saw a sort of increase in exchanges of fire between Israel and Hezbollah, and you saw an increased tempo of attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria by Iran-linked militias. And then you saw the Houthis surprising everybody by firing a ballistic missile at the southern Israeli resort city of Eilat, which is something I think a lot of people didn't even realize was they were capable of.
Yeah, I feel like we should contextualize and just talk about how far Yemen is away from Israel. Like, there's a reason why this is surprising. Like, it's not like they're next door neighbors.
No, they're not. Yemen sits more than 1,000 miles from Israel. You know, we know they have missiles. They've attacked targets in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates before, but they've never fired anything this far. So I think they've surprised a lot of people with both their military capabilities and with their global ambitions.
Can we just pause here and answer the question, who are the Houthis?
So the Houthis are a group. They're a member of a minority Shia Muslim sect in northern Yemen. And they first kind of came on the scene in the 1990s as a rebel group fighting against the government of the then dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh. Saleh was overthrown in Arab Spring-linked protests in 2012, which created this power vacuum in the country, which the Houthis took advantage of, and they seized the capital in 2014, and they still hold it today.
So they're like the de facto government in some areas, even though we call them a rebel group.
Right. They control about, I believe it's a third of Yemen's territory, but the most populous parts of the territory and the capital. But they're not recognized as the legitimate government of Yemen by the international community. You know, the Houthis, since they seized the capital in 2014, have been fighting this brutal civil war against Yemen's internationally recognized government, as well as a military coalition led by Saudi Arabia, which received a lot of funding and backing from the United States as well.
They have a pretty intense slogan, right? Like, death to America, death to Israel, damnation to the Jews. Like, that's not subtle.
Yeah, God is great, death to America, death to Israel, curse on the Jews, and victory for Islam. So this being their slogan, it definitely indicates that they have international ambitions, that they're concerned with more than just control of Yemen. But I think despite that, people have tended to sort of think of them in the past as a more kind of localized threat, but not one that sort of plays the international role that they have been for the last few weeks.
Yeah, my favorite quote about them came from this Yemeni analyst who gave a speech about like who are the Houthis and said, I think they dream that the Americans or Israelis attack them because then they'll become a real resistance force. And it just sort of it helps you understand who they are and their goals.
Yeah. You know, they've been telling their own fighters that they're fighting against the U.S. and Israel to the point that, you know, that there are some accounts where they interview some of these fighters who say like they were surprised that, you know, when they went to war, they weren't fighting against Americans or Israelis. They're like, we're fighting against other Yemenis mostly.
And they had been designated a terrorist organization, but then the U.S. downgraded them because aid needed to get into Yemen. Is that correct?
Yeah. So one thing that's been happening is that for the last 2 years, Yemen's been in a ceasefire. So while the sort of humanitarian situation's been extremely dire in that country still, there at least hasn't been fighting for the last couple of years. And the U.S. took the step of removing them from the designated terrorist list to allow sort of aid to continue to flow through into Yemeni-controlled areas of the country.
Because people in Yemen were starving. There were awful pictures of children and babies.
Yeah, and the UN has estimated that more than 377,000 people have been killed by this conflict, but the majority of those are not people who are actually killed by the fighting. Most of that's due to malnutrition, unsafe water, bad medical services. So this has been repeatedly described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. It arguably still is. And so I think that was part of the reason why they were taken off the list, was to just permit more aid to flow into the country. The Biden administration now is saying they're redesignating them as on the terrorist list and reimposing a lot of these sanctions because of the attacks on global shipping that we've seen.
So what did the Houthi attacks look like over the last couple of months? My impression just from reading is things kind of settled into this routine. They started attacking ships on the Red Sea. So when did it first become clear that that was going to be what they were doing?
Yeah, so this pattern kind of began in November. Houthi rebels boarded and seized the ship called the Galaxy Leader, which is partially owned by an Israeli businessman. And still, a lot of the articles about this, you see the pictures from that raid, which the Houthis distributed themselves, of these sort of armed gunmen, you know, descending from a helicopter onto the deck of the ship. Took the ship back to the coast of Yemen, where it still sits and where the crew of that ship are still being essentially held hostage.
That sounds like a really intense and very organized approach, like having a helicopter, getting on board a ship. I mean, this isn't just some guys in a boat with machine guns.
No, and I think you have to recognize their kind of the propaganda ability from this. So, because instantly there are sort of videos and photos of this, you know, broadcast throughout the world. So it was a major, not only demonstration of their military capabilities, but their propaganda operation as well. But that was a little more of an outlier. Mostly they've been sort of firing rockets or missiles or drones at ships in the Red Sea. And there have been sort of different methods. One that, you know, I think took a lot of military analysts by surprise and raised a lot of eyebrows. They've been firing ballistic missiles at ships. So, you know, a ballistic missile as opposed to a cruise missile, it travels a lot higher and a lot faster and is a lot more difficult to intercept with a lot of the sort of traditional naval countermeasures. And until now, anti-ship ballistic missiles have been sort of theoretical, like until the Houthis did it, no one had ever actually used one of these in combat. And it's the kind of thing, you know, military strategists talk about in a war with China. People wondered, you know, could the Chinese military really, you know, sink U.S. aircraft carriers with ballistic missiles?
So this is sophisticated.
It is sophisticated. Nobody really knew if even the Chinese military had the capability to do this, much less a group like the Houthis who just went ahead and did it.
You've written about how, I think, 12% of global trade flows through the Red Sea. So you can see why this approach from the Houthis would be incredibly problematic, not just for the United States or Israel, but for basically anyone who wants goods to come to them and that need to come to them over the ocean.
Right. A huge percent of global oil and natural gas has to pass through this very narrow passageway. And that gives the Houthis a tremendous amount of leverage, and they've taken full advantage of this geography.
How so? Like they're parked in front of these tiny little entrance and exit points or what?
Right. So there's not really any way around it. I mean, well, the way around it is you travel all the way around the coast of Africa, which adds at least 10 days travel time. And, you know, you think about the extra fuel costs, the extra costs you have to pay the crew. Since the 19th century, when the Suez Canal opened, this Red Sea route has facilitated a lot of east-west trade, particularly between Europe and the Middle East and East Asia. And now we see major shipping lines and major energy companies avoiding that route altogether. I mean, you see things like a Tesla plant in Germany had to sort of shut down operations for a week because they weren't getting the spare parts they needed from Asia.
So back in December, the U.S. announced they were forming this coalition to protect maritime interests in the Red Sea. They sent warships to the region. Did any of this do anything to make things safer or calm down the markets?
Well, I think one thing you can give the U.S. military and all these militaries involved credit for is they're pretty good at shooting down the Houthi missiles and rockets. They have a pretty high success rate at intercepting these. The problem is the amount of money insurance companies are charging these shipping companies. That's gone through the roof in the last few months. So eventually, it actually just becomes cost prohibitive to take this route as opposed to just shipping it around Africa. So that means big shippers like Maersk, the big Danish shipper, and Hapag-Lloyd, and you know, big energy companies like BP and Shell, they're all avoiding the Red Sea right now.
Eventually, after multiple warnings from the White House, the Biden administration opted to use firepower. Over the last week, they have launched a handful of airstrikes, which the Department of Defense claims will deteriorate the Houthis' ability to block global shipping.
But it doesn't seem to be having the deterrent effect they're hoping for. And I think it's worth keeping in mind, you know, the Houthis have been fighting a war against a, you know, U.S.-armed, Saudi-led coalition with overwhelming air superiority for a decade. So if that didn't stop them, then, you know, a few sort of targeted U.S. missile strikes, seems unlikely that's going to do it either.
After the break, the regional instability and violence continues to expand beyond the Red Sea.
The future of America is in your hands.
This is not a movie trailer, and it's not a political ad, but it is a call to action. I'm Mila Atmos, and I'm passionate about unlocking the power of everyday citizens. On our podcast, Future Hindsight, we take big ideas about civic life and democracy and turn them into action items for you and me. Every Thursday, we talk to bold activists and civic innovators to help you understand your power and your power to change the status quo. Find us at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Okay, so we've talked about the Houthi rebels and why it's so surprising that they've become main characters in the war in Gaza. Can we talk about some of the other Mideast players and escalations we've seen over the last few weeks? Because there have been a bunch of them and a bunch of smaller attacks. I sort of wonder if there's one attack or one genre of attack that particularly concerns you or got your attention.
It's interesting to watch what's been happening in Iraq, because you saw the U.S. launch a rare strike in Baghdad on the leader of one of these Iranian-backed militia groups. And you saw a few days ago, Iran actually launched an attack in Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish region, on what it said was a Mossad Israeli intelligence facility, but which also just appeared to be the compound of sort of a local businessman. And what struck me about that was it wasn't actually one of these proxy groups. It was Iran itself launching this missile and sort of stepping out from behind the veil of these groups they usually act through. And so that felt like an escalation to me.
Yeah, it also forefronts Iraq as this place where the U.S. military has withdrawn significant amounts of forces, but there's still so much happening there. Different countries in the region are definitely still using Iraq as kind of a home base, a place to operate from, and a place where, like, local disagreements are being, you can see them take place in real time.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. still has about 2,500 troops in Iraq and a few hundred in Syria as well. This is kind of the legacy of the war against ISIS. And that was sort of an interesting conflict because there you saw these Iran-backed militias that we're talking about now kind of fighting on the same side as the U.S. against the sort of common threat of ISIS. Now that ISIS is less of a factor, they're sort of turning on each other, and the Iran-backed groups are training their fire on the U.S. military in the region.
Yeah. And then over the last week, Iran and Pakistan started sparring. What happened there? Like, because, yeah.
Yeah, what is going on there? That was kind of a reminder that, you know, there are conflicts happening nearby and conflicts that involve Iran that actually sort of have very little to do with Israel or the United States. And you saw that this week with Iran firing a missile strike at this group in Pakistan, a separatist group that is sort of fighting for, you know, an independent state in both Pakistan and Iran. And so, you know, there are multiple things and there are connections between them, but the connections are sometimes a little tenuous. And so, you know, we talked earlier about Israel being drawn into a two-front war. I mean, Iran is fighting enemies on multiple fronts as well.
It's funny because Pakistan returned, you know, volleyed back when they were attacked by Iran. But then at the same time, they had these carefully crafted statements that they issued, basically saying, like, okay, like, now that we've gotten that out of our system, I think we can all say we're brotherly countries and dialogue and cooperation is important. And it was just so interesting to me as a representation of what this moment is, which is people skirmishing with each other, but then also very much wanting to keep the skirmishing under control.
We do have, in the past few years, examples of sort of major raging conflicts in the Middle East with huge numbers of casualties. You know, the war in Yemen, the war in Syria, what we're seeing in Gaza right now. But, you know, on the edge of those, what we see are this sort of dance of escalation and de-escalation where you see proxies firing at each other. You see sort of limited strikes, using missiles and drones. And so there's this kind of like low intensity conflict happening all around, which often doesn't lead to sort of all out conflict the way we've been seeing in these other places.
You know, we're talking about this low intensity conflict, but it is still hotter conflict than we had, I don't know, 6 months ago. And I do wonder what it would take to roll back what we've seen over the last few weeks and months. Like, is there a strategy for that you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was the now infamous foreign affairs article that Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, published right around the time of the October 7th attacks, which described the Middle East as being, you know, quieter than it's ever been in years. And I'm sure Sullivan regrets writing that. But, you know, at the time, it was true. I mean, there had been, you know, you saw Saudi Arabia and Iran talking to each other. You saw, sort of normalization happening between a lot of countries in Syria. I think that the problem was, like, during that period, a lot of people were just kind of sidelining the Israeli-Palestinian issue and assuming it would go away. But, and I think a lot of Arab governments hope for that as well. Like, as much as the Palestinian cause is like a live wire in Middle Eastern politics, I think a lot of their governments would prefer to just move on from that. But, I think in a really gruesome, horrible way, the October 7th attacks were a way of putting the Israeli-Palestinian conflict like very much back on everybody's global agenda. Like, there was no way to ignore it after that.
So all roads to de-escalation run through Israel and Gaza.
I think as long as the war in Gaza is raging, as long as the like level of casualties are as high as they are right now, and as long as there doesn't really seem to be a way out of it, it's hard to see how any of these other situations resolve themselves.
Josh Keating, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Keating is a senior correspondent at Vox, covering foreign policy and world news, with a focus on the future of international conflict. And that's the show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support us is to join Slate Plus. That's our membership program. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus and sign up. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. Catch you back here next time.